Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here again. I love this place. It's so pretty here, right? Such a nice drive up from Greenville. Once you get to the top of the mountain, it's a wonderful drive. It is great to be here. And today, me and the gods, is that ringing? Is that just me? Oh, okay. The gods and I, such as it is, are going to talk about finding a new pattern. This is a fairly common thread when I talk, and it's summer, so we're going to keep this fairly open and fairly informal. I didn't write a 19-page essay, which I will read. We were going to keep this open and honest. And in the blurb, I said to you, have you ever driven somewhere and gotten there and totally had no memory of having driven there, right? Your brain just kind of, someone drove the car. It wasn't you. Someone drove the car. Have you ever done that and gone to the wrong place? Like you pull up and you go, what am I doing? Oh. So these are examples of patterns, right? Obviously something recognized a pattern. So there are two kinds of patterns. You can separate patterns into two different types. The kind you recognize, the kind you're, let's say, conscious of, and the kind you're not conscious of. So if you drive to the wrong place, or if somewhere in your psyche drives to the car to somewhere, that's a pattern you're conscious of. Because you did it, you know, somewhere in your psyche, you know to drive to wherever it is you drove to, right or wrong, you know. There are also patterns that you don't know that you're part, that are part of you. There are patterns that are so regular to you that you don't even know that they're patterns. They're just considered to be normal for you. So these are the two kinds of patterns we're going to talk about. And specifically, we're going to focus on a couple patterns that maybe get a bum's rap when it comes to Unitarian Universalism. So let me ask you this question. Who is the highest educated religious group in America? Unitarians are second. So the highest educated group is the Hindus. And this makes sense when you think about it, because what happens is they get their education in India and then they come over here to take high-tech jobs. So a lot of Indians, there's a lot of very highly educated Indians that come here and then they join their temple when they get here. Unitarian Universalists are second. What this tends to mean is we've gone through a lot of formal education, and formal education tends to accentuate the cognitive and depress the non-cognitive thought pattern. So we tend to, as a group, highly prefer cognition up in your head. Has anybody ever told you, oh, you're all so up in your head, right? You're all up in your head. Even when you're trying to, I've had conversations with people trying to explain love to me. Oh, it's a neuron firing, and there are chemicals that go into your brain. So you're saying it's just like a biological mistake, love? Yes. I'm not there with that. I can't get there on that one, right? So nowhere, and then when you throw into the mix this whole thing in America, and I'm unprepared to talk about Virginia. I was busy yesterday. I don't even quite know what happened. But it doesn't surprise me. We've gone like this in America. It's all about separating now, right? And we do that. We do that. We don't even know we're doing it. That's a pattern we don't even know we're doing anymore, right? And one real example of that in the battle between cognition up in your head, and emotion, and spirit, and soul happened in 2005. A very interesting book came out. Many of you have read the book, or at least heard of the author, Malcolm Gladwell, who many of us know and love, wrote a book called Blink, right? Blink. Blink is asking you to recognize that you can think faster than you think you can think, basically, right? It was about that thick. It was real easy to read. If you haven't read it, read it. Start with the tipping point, because Blink doesn't make sense if you don't read the tipping point. But Blink, and he wrote Tipping Point, that book most people know, right? Blink challenged you to recognize that sometimes thinking doesn't really get you any better results than not thinking. And that's true, right? That's absolutely true. The other day I was sitting at the ballpark in Greenville, and I sit in a particular seat all the time, and I do that because I remember where my seat is, and there's a 3-foot wall in front of me, and a ball came whizzing right at me. It's a 3-foot wall, and that ball was 4 feet high. And it was on a line, and all I had time to do was yell, duck, and bend over, and it hit the person behind me. Now, I felt awful, but I mean, that ball was probably going 110 miles an hour. In my youth, I'd have stood up and tried to hand catch it. 52 years old, I ain't catching that. I'm just getting out of the way of that sucker. And anyway, so Blink, right? Blink has some value. And Malcolm Gladwell really investigated Blink. And here's where the separation happens. Not 1 year later, it was just a few days shy of 1 year later, a guy named Michael LaGault, who is also a famous writer for another, Malcolm Gladwell wrote for The Atlantic, Michael wrote for the Financial Times, put out a book called Think. And Think said, basically, that the world doesn't have enough cognitive thought. We can't think critically, which is true. We really can't think critically anymore, right? This group may be an exception, but for the most part, America is into the repeating right now, what he said or what she said, right? Thinking is sort of at a little bit of an all-time low. And what, let's be honest. And LaGault basically came out and said that, which was true. But the way he said it was that Blink was wrong. Well, both things can be true. Blink can be right, and we cannot have enough critical thought in America, right? Or anywhere else in the world. So here was this big separation that happened. It put us in this dualistic comfort zone. We're really comfortable in this dualistic comfort zone. Even people on the liberal side are comfortable going, they're wrong, right? And they're not all wrong. They're not. And that's as painful as that is. They're not all wrong. Okay, what does this mean to us as Unitarian Universalists? I'd like for you to open your hymnals and open your hymnals. I can't tell you what page because the pages aren't numbered, but it's generally speaking, it's the page right before the first hymn. So if you go to the first hymn and flip back one page, you should be on a page that has the principles and the sources on them. And we're going to look at what these principles and these sources tell us. These principles and these sources were finally written in 1985. Depending on which version of the hymnal you have, we add in another source later, and we're in the middle of adding another principle right now. But depending on which book you have, you either have five or six sources at the bottom. So I'd like to sort of pull this apart just a little bit, okay? And could we number them? No, we can't number them. So if you look up at the principles, we're looking at the fourth one. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning. This is often taken in our congregations to mean a cognitive search for truth and meaning. But is that what it says? Does this principle exclude accessing emotion, soul, and spirit from your search for meaning? How is it normally applied, though? Science, right? Science. Okay. And there's really nothing wrong with that. I'd also like you to look at the first source. Many people don't even know about the sources. How many of you, I won't embarrass you. How many of you didn't know about the sources? Yeah, sure, right? My wife, who's on the committee on ministry in Greenville, was reading through this with me, and she went, I've never seen these before. And that's just how it works, right? So I'd like you to look at the first source. This is what your forefathers wrote. Now, your forefathers are in the 70s and the 80s, but still, this is what these people were thinking not that long ago. One of the first source they chose to write down was a direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder, affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit. That doesn't sound very scientific to me. It doesn't sound very cognitive at all. Direct experience of the transcending mystery. I know there's a lot of people in here going, oh, hell no. Right? It's true. I know people who are doing that. So let's go back and look at a little bit of church history and see how we got to this. Church history. When I say church, I mean the Roman Catholic Church, because at the time I'm talking about, church and Roman Catholic Church were the same thing. There was only the one church. This is in Europe. There was a period of time where the Roman Catholic Church became what's called a temporal power. They had money, an army, and they were a king. The Pope wasn't a Pope, he was a king. This got a lot of people very upset and very nervous. It got the religious people nervous, and it got the temporal people nervous. Layer into that at this time, the popes were Spanish, which really got a lot of people upset, okay? So you got this rift in the church. And the rift happened, it had to happen around theology. It couldn't happen around money and war. That would be not church-like. So it happened around theology. And what really happened was lots of people started saying the church doesn't have all the authority over theological matters. And of course the church went, yes we do. And there was an argument there, and that argument we basically called the Reformation, right? 500 years ago this year, a guy named Martin Luther got mad enough that he finally nailed his complaint to the church door. And that's how the Reformation began. That sort of comes out in our psyches today, where we don't like to be told what to believe, right? We want to figure out what to believe ourselves. So you take we want to figure out, you add in this hyperactive affection for cognitive thought, and what do you get? You get a very scientific view, a very scientific way of understanding the way the world works. Have you ever heard the saying, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail? Does that make any sense to you? Where it gets difficult is, and I experienced this in Clemson, there were some people in Clemson who were really, really, really spiritual people. And it was difficult for them to really socially integrate into the rest of the church. If they believed that God talked to them, that alienated them with some of the other members of the church, right? Direct talking to God. But our forefathers were talking about direct experience of the transcendent. They couldn't say God, but direct experience of the transcendent is somewhere along those lines, right? So don't put your hymnals away. We're going to talk about this in another minute. And let's look at a quick question. This is a very common question in churches. I'm going to ask this question not because I think it's a question we need to deal with. I'm going to ask this question because it fits the topic, okay? Have you ever been asked, have you ever thought about, have you ever wondered about whether there is or isn't a God? This is a fairly common question in churches, right? Okay. Here's my thought process on that, and see if this works for some of you. If you ask me whether I think there's a God, I'm going to think about it. And if I think about God, I end up firmly on no. I can't get to a point cognitively where I can say there is a God. It doesn't work for me. Might work for some of you. God could be totally logical. It's not logical for me. If you ask me whether I feel there's a God, yes, absolutely I feel there's a God. So you ask me whether I believe in God, I'm going to say yes. To many of you, that's a cognitive failure. Thank you for coming. We're done here. I don't care where I was anyway. Did you forget where you were? Who cares where I was? God is talking. God, the UCC church says God is still talking. Right? Well, there you go. All right, so what I'm asking you to do is instead of, and here's how I came to this realization. I really was ambivalent about whether there was a God or not, because what I cared about was not whether there was or wasn't a God, but how I lived my life. If God made me live a good life, then fine. If God made me made a lousy life, then I didn't really want there to be a God, right? So, push this along. How did I get to a point where I realized that I actually did believe in God? It wasn't thinking about it. It was looking at the evidence. I played Sherlock Holmes on myself. What did I do? When the going gets tough, did I pray? No, I really didn't do that. But I did certain things that made me think maybe I actually do believe in God. Okay? And I observed those behaviors in myself. That's the different path I'm talking about. I'm not even talking about looking for a different path. I'm talking about looking for the patterns that you already do and seeing what that really means about you. Trying to check yourself out. Instead of checking God out, check yourself out to see how you connect with the divine. And it's important to note that one of the things that really pushes people a little bit in Unitarian churches is this whole concept of irrationality. Right? Do I think there's a God? No. Do I feel there's a God? Yes. So then no. No. Right? You can't get to a point where you feel there's a God. That doesn't make any sense for a lot of people. I'd like you to look back in your hymnal again, same page. There was a, and some of you might have been, I see Helen Bishop is here, some of you might have been even involved in this in the 80s and 70s, but there was a strong push at the formation of the Unitarian Universalist Association to include humanists. In 2017, humanism has become a little bit more synonymous with atheism than it was in 1988, okay? Humanism is sort of like a euphemism for atheism now. I want to disprove this to you by looking at the very, so, again, depending on which edition you have, it's either the last source or the one right before the last source. It starts with the word humanist. I'm letting you know what your ancestors thought. Humanist teachings would counsel us to heed the guidance of reason. Okay, listen to reason, right? Important. Nobody's saying don't listen to reason. Not even Malcolm Gladwell said don't listen to reason. Heed the guidance of reason and the results of science. Good idea. If you're building a bridge, I don't want you to feel that the bridge will stay up. I want you to know that the bridge will stay up. If you're putting a roof on a building, I don't want God to tell you that the roof will stay up. And the results of science, and here's the kicker, and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Idolatries of the mind and spirit. If you're anything like me, I had to look that up. I didn't know what that meant. That came from a guy named James Luther Adams, who said, don't just substitute science for God. Don't just worship science like it was a god. He didn't say, he's much more eloquent than that, but that's basically what he said. Idolatries of the mind and spirit. And you don't want to idolize the spirit either, right? If you're going to build a bridge, science is a really good thing. So let me give you another couple of quick stories about how this happened to me and how it might happen to you. First story. 5 years ago, not 100 years ago, 5, if you'd have met me, I would have vehemently argued that there is no such thing as the subconscious. It's a joke, it's hocus pocus, and it's a lot of other words that I shouldn't say from a pulpit. Absolutely believed it, could have argued around it all day. And then, in an educated session, when we were looking at self-awareness, someone proved to me that I had a subconscious. We were doing this thing, and it was an exercise where we had to take something that we, how we reacted to something, and how we were surprised by our own reaction to something. And there's this group where we all dug into what was behind that. And we got to the point where we kind of realized what was behind that for me. And the supervisor, who knew that I didn't believe in the subconscious, looked at me and said, so if that's not a subconscious, what is? And it was like, oh, I do have a subconscious. And my whole world exploded, right? This is a big deal. It may not seem like a big deal, especially if you already thought you had a subconscious, but I didn't. Now I've got this thing. So I've only had this subconscious for 5 years. We're still getting to know each other. But I recognize that it's true, which is a really big deal for me. The other thing I'll tell you is I was preaching in Clemson, and this woman, who was formerly a Catholic nun, walked up to me and said, so you're Jungian. Hell no, I'm not Jungian. Jung was a kook. I'm not Jungian. Oh yes, you are. You're a practitioner of active imagination. Oh, this lady's crazy. What is she talking about? Well, guess what? 2 weeks later, she had me absolutely convinced that not only was I Jungian, I was like hyper Jungian. I was more Jungian than she was. She convinced me that I needed to find my spirit guide. If you could only know how weird that was for me to be convinced that I needed to find my spirit guide. Absolutely convinced. Yep, you got me. I got to find my spirit guide. And I found my spirit guide. It was so easy to find my spirit guide. It was right in front of my face the whole time. I just couldn't see it. Somebody pointed it out to me, and there it was. So it turns out, not only did I, A, firmly believe in my own subconscious while vehemently arguing against the same, not only was I firmly Jungian, I still don't really know what that means, but because some of you are psychologists, don't come up to me after that. I don't really know all the details of that. But I'm firmly, apparently, Jungian, and I believe in spirit guides. That's a lot to digest in 5 years, right? That's heavy thinking. But I will tell you, it opened up the world to me. It was amazing what changes happened. because of these little teeny tiny things. And what I realized, and this is not a thing that people are going to really, some people are going to, the universality of truth does not necessarily apply in all conditions. I believe that I might have a spirit guide, but you might not, and that's perfectly okay. But I'm suggesting to you that you might have a spirit guide and might just not know it. Now, that's not okay. Does that make sense? That doesn't make sense. If a pattern is right there in front of you, but you refuse to see it or can't see it, that doesn't mean the pattern's not there. It's there. And you seeing it will open up your life. You seeing it will open up your soul. You seeing it will open up your spirit. Even if you don't think you have a soul, don't worry about that. It'll still get opened up. And it's okay. Even if you don't think you have a spirit, don't worry about it. You cannot have a spirit and have it opened up. Does that make that, right? That's hard, right? That's difficult. So I am constantly looking for new patterns in myself. And I suggest to you that 5 years ago, I would not even have, if you'd have told me I'd been preaching about spirit guides 5 years ago, there's no way. Now, I'm new at it. I'm not exactly an expert at it. But it's really filled me with a lot of joy and a lot of passion. And here's the other thing. I can see patterns in you that you might not be able to see. Not you. I mean, I've never met it. But I can see patterns in other people. And it is a wonderful experience. It is super experience. And what I did was I simply put down this worship of science, this worship of fact. Facts, you know, the universality of truth doesn't apply in all circumstances. Boy, that's the one thing that applies, right? Because it's one of those negative things that can't apply if it doesn't apply. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just asking you to look at this as it applies to your own life, as it applies to the way you function in the day. And I'll leave you with one more brief anecdote. And I want to point something out. For those of you who are looking to find a new pattern, I happened to be reading this before I got going. And this Thursday, right here in the fellowship hall, which I think is downstairs, right? Astrological influences on our lives during the solar eclipse. 5 years ago, I could not have cared less about that. Now, I want to go see what this is all about. I don't know what it means. I'm not even quite sure what astrology is, but I want to go see what this means. There might be something there that I believe in that I don't even know I believe in. Or there might be something there that might be helpful to me that I don't even know I need. I don't even know what it is. Worst case scenario, I sit in a room with a bunch of my friends for 2 hours talking about things, right? How bad could that possibly be? The opportunities are in front of you, and I'll leave you with one quick little anecdote. And I appreciate you very much, and I thank you very much for having me again. And I will tell you that probably about 4 months ago, I caught myself doing something that I found very weird. I was leading a prayer. A group of people, a mixed, I didn't know these people, so I assume they were Christian because they're from here, and I'm leading this prayer, and when I lead prayers with mixed people, I try to stick to Christianity because it's safer. So I'm leading this prayer, and in the middle of the prayer, I realized 3 times I referred to God in the plural. What was that? Here amongst all the gods, I said. 3 times I said it. And I was consciously trying to stick to Christianity because I didn't want to rub anybody the wrong way. Turns out I rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And I really did a lot of work on that. I did a lot of meditation on that. I did a little thought on that. Turns out, guess what? I'm a polytheist. Woohoo! So I went from being basically an atheist to being a polytheist in 5 years, not by thinking my way there, but by observing my own behavior and going, huh, here in the presence of all the gods, who said that? I believe that was me who said that. So I think that I'm just asking you to look for patterns in your own behavior. Place Sherlock Holmes on yourself. You can't do it on someone else, because that comes off really wrong, right? Ha ha, you're a polytheist. Yeah, that doesn't work. But you can do it on yourself. I have felt much more fulfilled since I've done that, and I invite you to do the same. And you can start on Thursday looking at astrology right here in the fellowship hall. Thank you very much. Love to be here. Thank you very much.